Okay, well, I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you all about some Gulf Coastal Plain soils. And at this point, I would certainly like to acknowledge my co-author, Dr. Ben Hayak. Several of you all know Ben and recognize the significant contributions he's made in this arena over the years, and I clearly want to mention that. So when we look at the Southern Coastal Plain, it's composed of basically two areas, the Atlantic Coastal Plain to the east and then the Western Coastal Plain here. Alabama, of course, sits intermediate. I'm going to concentrate my discussion on MLRA 133A within the Coastal Plain region of Alabama, and I'll leave Willie to talk a little bit more about Florida. So the Coastal Plain comprises about 60% of Alabama. It ranges in elevations up to over 700 feet as you get close to the fall line. It's a range of lithologies, kind of as Christine was showing, representing a suite of depositional environments and a range of ages, from Cretaceous up near the fall line down to, of course, Holocene as we get close to the present-day coast. So, a couple of things that make this part of the Coastal Plain unique. A lot of y'all are familiar with the Atlantic Coastal Plain studies that have mapped out the terraces and scarps and those geomorphic surfaces where they relate the soils to those particular geomorphic surfaces. Classic study by Gamble and Daniels in the 70s where they did that. In Alabama, our terraces only extend about 50 miles inland from the coast. So we relate our soils in the Coastal Plain mostly to the underlying lithology instead of the geomorphic terrace surfaces. Another distinction I'll make here is that we have a prominence of what we call questas within Alabama. These questas are resistant lithology. They separate lithologic beds, and what they essentially are resistant ridges of lithology, suggesting that there's been significant erosion in these landscapes. And that's important when I'll come back to this in a minute when we talk a little bit more about soil development. So in line with that, Alabama represents somewhat of a transitional nature. We share the highly weathered mineralogy, low activity clays that we see in the Atlantic Coastal Plain. Throughout the region, we see a lot of iron enriched subsoils, which I'm going to discuss plinthite. And then we also share some aspects with what we see to the west in Mississippi with actually pedogenic carbonates. So Dave and Christine, you're not the only ones that have pedogenic carbonates. We have them, and in a humid region, of course, that's a little bit strange. So, large portions of the Atlantic and Gulf Coastal Plain consist of highly weathered soils. These soils are commonly ultrasoils. Most of them have candic horizons, as represented by this blue distribution here. I will note here, notice in Alabama where you start seeing a distinction in the amount of candic horizons going across the state. I'll get back to that. If they're not in candic horizons, a lot of them are in subactive CEC classes. So all of them are representative of a very low activity as represented by the CEC to clay ratio. Now, not all of y'all work with candic horizons, so just for a refresher, these things were introduced in 1987 by the International Committee of Low Activity Clays. They were developed to characterize and categorize soils with accumulations of low activity clays, and of course this is important because soils with low activity clays typically have a lower plasticity, dispersion and swelling potential, and higher amounts of permeability, shear strength, anion absorption, phosphorus fixation, and of course water stable aggregates. So the Southeastern Soil Mineralogy Project, which was active for several decades up into the 2000s, developed a soil mineralogy map. And within these highly weathered systems, they denoted what they called a monorthic component within the clay fraction. And what that basically means is clay fractions consisting mostly of kaolinite, hydroxyinterlayer vermiculite, which I'm going to come back to, gibbsite, iron oxides, quartz, mica, smectite's present, but it's usually present in just trace quantities. And then the coarse fragments are usually siliceous, and that means that they're dominantly quartz. But there are a few weatherable minerals largely in this. So this hydroxyinterlayer vermiculite is of importance here because this is a mineral we believe to be largely pedogenic or significantly pedogenically altered. Now, it's essentially a solid solution with vermiculite on one end and a chlorite-like member on the other. It can basically be referred to as a dioctahedral vermiculite with non-exchangeable aluminum polymers within the interlayer. This is important because those hydroxyaluminum polymers greatly decrease the activity of the mineral. So it doesn't behave like vermiculite at all. In fact, it behaves like a low activity mineral because of this offsetting. Many of you all are familiar with, if you look in the literature, there's been a lot of terms used to describe this mineral over the years. Partially, right, Daryl, because this mineral is a solid solution. There's a lot of things that have composed it. So it's been referred to in a lot of different ways. And of course, when you're dealing with clay mineralogy, you showed an x-ray slide, so I have to show one too. Clearly, XRD is our underpinning. When you look at something like hydroxyurea vermiculite, it's got a characteristic 14 angstrom peak that upon heating will begin to collapse towards 10 angstrom, and it's the nature of this collapse which says a lot about the infilling of the aluminum polymers within the interlayer, and the temperature by which that collapse begins also speaks to the actual character of that inner filling, of the interlayer filling. So if we're going to talk about highly weathered sweets, we have to be able to quantify the minerals. Now, some of the minerals are very readily quantified. For example, kaolinite and many of the iron oxides, we can use thermal techniques. But something like hydroxyinterlayer vermiculite is much more complicated for quantifying. So oftentimes we use techniques including XRD with an internal standard. The way that would work is we would quantify something like kaolinite and then ratio the XRD peaks to come up with an approximate amount for the mineral. Now, more elaborate techniques will actually use a total reconstruction where you'll actually take the sample, digest it completely down, take the elements from this, and then allocate it to your known mineral quantities, and then what's left is what you basically can reconstruct the quantity for something like hydroxyinterlayer vermiculite, and it also allows you to actually reconstruct a structural formula for the mineral as well. Now, with any of these approaches, something that's useful is what we call a deconvolution of the initial patterns, whether you're doing it with thermal patterns or with X-ray, and this allows you to get the unique individual signatures because so many of these signatures and these analytical techniques overlap. So if you can deconvolve them, you can definitely get better quantities. And I mentioned to you that you can actually approximate some formulas. So this has been done for hydroxyinterlayer vermiculite, and it's been done in, this is actually more extensive than the coastal plain. But a composite of this suggests the mineral with a layer charge of about 0.85, with about 60 to 70% of the layer charge compensated by these aluminum hydroxy polymers. So once you get this and you get some good quantities, you're actually able to look a little bit at the depth distribution of some of these minerals. And in these highly weathered systems, what you typically see is an enrichment of hydroxyinterlayer vermiculite in the near surface and a relative enrichment of kaolinite compared to hydroxyinterlayer vermiculite in the subsoil. And this is kind of interesting, and this has been quite a little bit of work done on trying to describe why this is the case. So once you actually develop a structural formula for a mineral, then you can do some thermodynamic soil solution work. And we've done a little bit of this, and what you basically find within these coastal plain settings is that the near surface environments are more saturated with regards to hydroxyinterlayer vermiculite than the subsoil. So this is kind of consistent with what you see with the depth trends. We recognize thermodynamics can't be used exclusively for answering these kinds of questions, but it's of note that it actually is somewhat consistent with some of the depth trends that we've seen. However, you know, you work in these systems long enough, you know that it's much more complicated than that, and there's probably several other explanations on why we see these particular depth trends. Some have suggested that Lucian Zelazny did several years ago, that those aluminum interlayers provide a kinetic stability to that particular mineral. Willie has shown that it depends on which size fraction you analyze. If you look at the coarse clays, because hydroxyinterlayer vermiculite is typically concentrated in the coarse clay, probably due to a mica precursor, then you're going to get different than if you look at the fine clays. Particle size effects. Kaolinite is typically finer grain, so it could be preferentially alluviating, which would cause a relative enrichment of hydroxyinterlayer vermiculite at the surface. This is somewhat compounded by the thickness of the sandy epipedons, because you tend to get a consistent quantity of hydroxyinterlayer vermiculite through the sandy zones, but then when you cross across the alluvial boundary, then you see some larger differences, and Willie showed that a few years ago, Willie, not too long. Potentially less source material for kaolinite at the surface. If you don't have as much feldspars and whatnot for kaolinite to form, that can be a factor as all. So the question becomes, now that we understand a little bit more about the pedon distribution of these minerals, is why do we have highly weathered mineral systems to begin with? Why do they even exist? Clearly a warm, humid climate that we've had the last several thousand years plays a role here. There's ample evidence that we had some extensively warm and humid climates during portions of the Pliocene and the Miocene, so that could definitely be playing a role. Something that can't be discounted is the recycled sedimentary parent material. So there's been some classic work done by Daniels in the Atlantic Coastal Plain, and we've done some in the some additional work in the Gulf Coastal Plain that has showed that if you've got a pre-weathered materials and you move these materials around and redeposit them, they're going to carry that highly weathered signature with them. So it's not a leap of logic to see where the initial sediment source is going to have an effect on the soils that translate down the line. And then something else that I think is critical here with these highly weathered systems is landscape stability. If you work in this part of the world, what you find out is in the eastern Gulf Coastal Plain and then translating into the Atlantic Coastal Plain, a lot of our landscapes fit what we call a back-wearing or parallel slope retreat model of hill slope development. Now, if you're familiar with this, what this means is basically the hill slopes develop, and then over time, your side slopes essentially slough off, but the inner foods, the upper highest portions of your landscapes remain relatively stable. So they can be subjected to relatively long-term soil development, and you get some large differences in geomorphic age between what's on top and what's on the side slope. And we feel like this model of hill slope development is very applicable in portions of our coastal plain. So this long-term stability is a key aspect. But then the question becomes, what's long-term? What's the time frames that we're talking about here? Well, as it turns out, in Alabama, just like Christine was talking about, the terraces of the Brazos, we also have significant terrace systems, some of them associated with our Alabama River. And about 25 years ago, a fluvial chronosequence study was conducted over seven terrace levels to kind of look at the soil development as a function of time. Because you recognize that if we can actually date those terrace levels, then we can start to develop some time frames for soil development. Again, this study was started in the 1970s, and we finished this thing up about 10 years ago. I do need to acknowledge, some of y'all know Dr. Warren Lynn. Warren was a key player in this study for many years, and we certainly recognize his contributions. So, in line with that, these Alabama terraces are what we consider to be climactic aggradation surfaces. They were mostly formed during the Pleistocene. They're what we would call diachronous, which means that their time changes as we go from north to south across these terraces. Now, the age estimates themselves are actually based on several references, and they're just that. They're estimates, but they give us some pretty good relative assessment of what's going on. Now, of course, the terraces remain because essentially the gravels keep that landscape stable, and the sandy epipedons have relatively high infiltration rates, so you don't get as much erosion of those landscapes. So you put this all together, and you start backing out over these 29 pedons. You start developing some relationships between some of our standard pedogenesis metrics and age. So this first plot here is the depth of soil, the thickness of your B horizons, essentially, right? And what you basically see with this is that you, at about 60,000 years, you get a point in time where the depth of soil begins to kind of level off. Clay content at roughly over 100,000 years, you start to see a similar pattern. There's something else going on here at the end, but there's a little bit of stability in there as well. Diathionite extractable iron, which we also know is an indicator of soil development. Again, the 60,000 year mark, 60 to 70,000 year mark tends to show up as well. And then, of course, our CEC to clay ratio, which speaks to the highly weathered nature, we begin to see that really highly weathered signature roughly that 60 to 70,000 year mark as well. So although this is not exact, we oftentimes wonder how much time does it take to form these sorts of features that we're seeing in some of these things. Well, at least with these sorts of plots, we might start to have an idea of what's going on with this. If we want to get into the mineralogy a little bit, these are plots of kaolinite and hydroxyanilate vermiculite with depth. These are the oldest terrace levels. These are actually over a million years and progressively younger down to less than 50,000 years. But we see in these oldest terrace level this characteristic enrichment of hydroxyanilate vermiculite at the surface and relative enrichment of kaolinite in the subsoils. And this holds pretty true until you start getting again around that 50, 60,000 year mark. And you start to lose that kind of characteristic and it becomes a lot more convoluted. So it's interesting that the mineralogy is consistent with some of our other pedogenic markers with regards to these soil systems as well, and tells a little bit of a somewhat consistent story there. Something I want to mention that I brought up earlier. When you go from east to west across our coastal plain, you'll notice that we have these candic horizons, which again are characteristic of the lowest activity soils, but then we start to lose these basically when you get past Montgomery, Alabama, if you're familiar with that, into West Alabama. Now, there's some differences in lithology that cause some of that, but keeping all this consistent, the question becomes, why is that? And I feel like there's really three things going on here. First off, when you go from east to west, what you tend to get in the western part of the state is a little bit more silt. And if you pick up a little bit of silt, if you're normalizing the CEC to clay and developing that ratio, if there's any CEC in the silt at all, it's going to artificially inflate that value. So that's kind of a pragmatic reason why this is probably occurring. And I think that certainly has some relevance. But also we have to go back to the sediment source question. We've already said that this plays a role with activity. If you take on logic that the Piedmont Plateau has contributed more sediments to this part of the coastal plain than the Paleozoic Plateau has contributed to this part, in the Piedmont we have predominantly candic horizons and a higher degree of soil development and weathering than we get on the residual soils on these Paleozoic rocks. So because of that, that signature may also be playing a role in why we're getting the more low activity soils in the southeastern part of the state. And the last thing I'll leave, which I think actually is pretty important here as well, I mentioned to you that this back wearing is kind of what we believe is a common hill slope development model in the southeastern part of the state and then into the Atlantic coastal plain. As you start proceeding further west, you start seeing more of those cuestas or those resistant ridges. Anytime you've got those resistant ridges outcropping, it's definitely suggesting that there's been significant erosion. So I think there's also some significant difference in landscape age going across here. So you put it all together, and I think that's largely what controls those candic distribution. All right. Second topic, plinthite. A lot of us are familiar with plinthite. If you work in this region, you almost have to be. It's an iron-rich, humus-poor mixture of clay and quartz and occurs in many different forms. It's firm to very firm when moist, hard when dry. It essentially represents a continuum of cementation, sometimes referred to from a coarse fragment discussion as a pararock. And over time, it changes irreversibly to ironstone. So this is a concentration of iron cemented materials which occurs in a lot of our coastal plain soils. And when I say a lot, here's a distribution map of soils with plinthite within the coastal plain. So again, Alabama shares this characteristic with the soils to our states to the east and the states to the west. And of course, Alabama has a high contingent of plinthite in it. In fact, plinthite's been mapped on over 13 million acres and in many different series. And as you can see, it's essentially a ubiquitous feature in the coastal plain. When you look at the way plinthite exists within a Pedon scale, you see some things that are fairly consistent across all of this region. First off, you tend to see a little bit more ironstone in the upper part of the profile. Now, the reason why we believe that ironstone is concentrated in the upper part is, again, when plinthite irreversibly hardens to ironstone, it's undergone repeated wetting and drying. So it makes sense that up in this upper part, you probably go through some more frequent wetting and drying cycles, so you could probably irreversibly harden plinthite. In addition, a lot of this ironstone is nodular, so there may be some transport mechanisms going on here as well. You know, the stuff that's been moved in, or perhaps it's a lag concentrate when other stuff has been preferentially removed. Now, the plinthite itself is actually concentrated above this reticularly modeled zone that we've oftentimes referred to in the coastal plain as brick, because that's essentially how it behaves. It's structureless material, and if you look at the modeling patterns and the way it is, it's certainly suggestive of a past hydrologic regime. It's a paleosol. It's probably a climactic paleosol, but it may even be a lithologically discontinuous paleosol, but it clearly has the remnants of some polygenetic pathways, right? And because of its impermeability, it essentially perches water above it. And since it perches water above it, this is where we get our highest concentration of plinthite sitting right on top of the zone. Now, from a landscape perspective, what we tend to see is there's been a lot of studies done looking at how plinthite has developed. Now, one thing that's obviously important is that you have iron in the perimeter. You have to have some iron. But from a landscape development standpoint, after you deposit a material and you start to have uplift and hill slope development, I think there's some lateritization processes that are going on where the water tables are relatively high, iron is solubilized, it's moved down into the lower parts of the landscape, and then over time may in fact start to cement the material. And when this material becomes more cemented, I think you also run into, and we have ample evidence of this, a significant landscape inversion. So what essentially happens is you have this plinthic cementation of this landscape, and we see that with some of our soil distribution. And here's a block diagram illustrating our plinthic soils being at the most highest portion, oldest, probably Miocene age landscape levels, and then you get these younger side slopes, possibly owed to a back-wearing sort of hill slope development, and you don't tend to see flinthite in those soils. So there's clearly a time frame associated here and potentially some inversion mechanisms going on. Well, if you read any of the literature on some of the tropics and soil development in the tropics, you'll see some similar sorts of things there with that. So I think this is pretty consistent. But one thing that is not consistent between the other international system soil of soil classification, the WRB, and soil taxonomy is the way that we characterize flinthite. We've done a lot of study characterizing, and there's a lot of studies that have been done on the literature. The WRB doesn't even recognize flinthite until you have 10% iron within the feature. No data that we've seen suggests 10% iron in any of our flinthite. They also recognize flinthite needs 2.5% iron in the fine earth fraction. The data in the southeast does not support that as well. So we clearly have some work to do in the international community to describe and characterize the flinthite more consistently. We have done work on laterite here in the last few years, and we're doing a little better with that. But, of course, flinthite is a more specific term than laterite, and we definitely have some work to do there. So what are the implications on soils with flinthite? Clearly, a soil fertility standpoint, these tend to be not very fertile soils. They tend to be acid. There's some pyrolysis that goes on in these things. There's mechanical strength from the cementation. It affects hydraulic properties. But what we've been interested in is what does it mean from a hydromorphology standpoint? Because it's the cemented feature. So there's questions on does it really reflect contemporary saturation or are there other things going on? So we had a study a few years ago where we had 11 sites. Seven of these soils were in plinthic subgroups, and I think we had over 30 horizons that had flinthite in them. And we monitored water tables for several years to try to get an idea of not just flinthite, but other hydromorphic features, but describe those relationships with the seasonal high water tables. And it turns out with regards to flinthite, that flinthite existed in horizons that were saturated from 1 to 47% of the time, and about 20% of the time on average. So it was pretty clear that flinthite was not necessarily reflective consistently across all moisture patterns. And when we started to parse this out even further and looked at flinthite saturation in what we consider to be well-drained pedons versus things that were more imperfectly drained, there was a huge distinction between what flinthite represented with regards to saturation. So the take-home message on flinthite here with regards to its relationship to contemporary saturation is it depends. It depends on where it is and cannot be used on its own as a contemporary saturation metric, at least from the data that we've collected. The last thing I want to mention, Dave, you talked about verdisols and carbonates, and I didn't want us to be left out of this discussion. If you're familiar with Alabama and then on into Mississippi, there's a lens here of Cretaceous chalks. We call this the Blackland Prairie region. Over these Cretaceous chalks, we get a suite of different soils. We get clayey alkaline verdisols. We get acid verdisols. And we also get shallow to chalk insectosols that form in this region. And if we look at a distribution of these soils, what we'll commonly see is these alkaline verdisols in the highest portions of the landscape, right adjacent to some of these shallower to chalk insectosols. These things are carbonatic, oftentimes calcareous to the surface. And then at slightly lower elevations, we'll begin to see the more acid distridurt. So the question becomes, what's driving the distribution of these soils? Why do we have these alkaline and acid soils in close proximity? And, of course, you can reconcile some of this from a soil development standpoint. We have ample examples of acid soils forming over calcareous parent materials in many humid regions. So that's not unique. So clearly weathering could be playing a role. But you can't just count discontinuous parent materials. And so these are data taken from an alkaline haplodirt, Houston series, and this is from an acid distridurt, what we call the Octibiahall series. What's consistent between both of these soils is that we have a high amount of carbonate in the lower parts of the soil. What is not consistent is when we start looking at some of these things that are indicative of lithologic discontinuities, we definitely see some more noise, more evidence of polygenetic pathways, discontinuities within the acid soils than we see in the alkaline soils. So the predominance of evidence seems to suggest it's not necessarily a weathering mechanism going on here. In fact, some have suggested there's an Eocene cap of acid marine clays, and our data would be consistent with that. So, but I digress. What I'm really interested in is these lower carbonates in the lower parts of the soil. So there's ample micro and macromorphological evidence that these carbonates in the lower solum are pedogenic or significantly pedogenic. Why is that unique? Well, as these folks from Texas have shown you, carbonates are a semi-arid feature, right? Not necessarily. If we think about it from a soil development standpoint, if you've got real clayey subsoils, which essentially are relatively impermeable, you can create environments subjacent to that where that aren't highly leached. And you're over calcareous paramaterials, you can supersaturate with regards to calcium carbonate, and you get evidence of secondary carbonates. But it's not enough just to have visual evidence. I know the mineralogists need to see a little bit more than this. So we actually took some of these forms and did some isotope works, some carbon and oxygen isotope works, separated pedogenic forms, which we separated into nodular and soft accumulations, and then compared those to what we would call the lithogenic carbonates. So there's been work like this done in Texas. We did a similar approach. And it turns out that they all pattern in different ways, which at least suggests that this gives evidence that these clearly are some pedogenic forms, but there also may be some differences in the time frame of development, even pedogenically with these forms. But the preponderance of evidence suggests we have significant pedogenic carbonate in a humid region, which is not what we always think about when we think about our soil development. The old pedicals and pedalfers, Nikki, wouldn't work in this sort of approach. So I think that's basically kind of conclusion slide, but those are the three things I wanted to make out. The take-home message is Alabama has a great variety of soils, largely because of where we sit, and come see us.